You're listening to episode 203 of the Pastor Writer Podcast, conversations on reading, writing, and the Christian life. I'm your host, Chase Replogle. If you're a pastor or someone who pays attention to things related to the church, you certainly understand that we're living in challenging times. Most pastors I talk to recognize they're facing challenges they haven't faced before, and that many of the things they've long been doing don't seem to have the same impact, the same effect. Whenever I'm thinking about cultural issues the church is facing, one of my favorite authors to turn to is Andrew Root. He wrote the series Ministry in a Secular Age, which has been really helpful for processing the times we do our work in. And he has a new book out he joins me today to talk about, entitled When Church Stops Working. It was a really fascinating conversation about how the world is changing and how the church has struggled to respond to it. Andrew offers some really helpful advice, some wise advice, and I think one that'll be an encouragement to you. As always, thanks for listening. Well, I'm joined on the podcast today by Andrew Root. He's the Kerry Olson Balson Professor of Youth and Family Ministry at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. Andrew writes and researches in the areas of theology, ministry, culture, and younger generations. It's been an honor to have him on the podcast before. We've talked about his Ministry in a Secular Age series, which I highly recommend. And he's got a few new books out. His most recent books, Churches and the Crisis of Decline, and the book he joins me today to talk about, When Church Stops Working, A Future for Your Congregation Beyond More Money, Programs, and Innovation. Well, Andrew, it's an honor always to get to talk to you, and a privilege to have you back on the Pastor Writer podcast.
Oh, it's just great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, maybe give us catch us up a little bit on what you've been working on, and are you still interested in the secular age and working out what ministry looks like? I know that series was so impactful to me, and kind of where that's taking you and the work you're doing now.
Yeah, well, thanks. I appreciate that. In some ways, the series was supposed to end and it hasn't ended. I guess I have a hard time ending things. So, you know, it was supposed to be three. In some sense, it is three. It's, you know, the faith formation in a secular age, the pastor in a secular age, and the congregation in a secular age. But then there's kind of three volumes that come out after that. So as you were nice enough to reference, the Churches in the Crisis of Decline, and then there's a book called The Church After Innovation, and then this October there's a book that I can't remember the title of, but it's something like The Church and Secular Mysticisms, that's kind of looking at the spirituality dynamic of our cultural reality. But one of the great benefits of those books has been that there's been a lot of pastors who have used them in their, or they frame their thinking enough that they've tried to take those ideas to their councils and their sessions and their other leadership, lay leadership within their church. But then they would call me up and be like, how do you talk about this with, you know, lay folks? Because those books are not easy. And so this book is kind of born out of that. When Church Stops Working, is it's supposed to kind of be at lay level, on the ladder of reading. And then it's the idea is that you would read it with a group of folks. So the secular age stuff is really deep within it, but it's trying to maybe put it at a little lower level that can help pastors and congregation leaders and folks like that wrestle with some of these ideas.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I have a copy of The Church and Innovation on my shelf. I haven't got to it yet, but I'm planning to. And I noticed, though, having flipped through it, that it seemed like some of the themes were working themselves out in this book we're talking about today, When Church Stops Working. How did it come about specifically, this book? And I noticed also it's co-authored. Maybe a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, it really did come about because people would write me and say, "Can you come on Zoom?" Or they'd be nice enough to fly me to their church, and they would have, you know, some team within their congregation that was like the new vision team, or it was just their kind of council, and they would just kind of tee me up and be like, "Hey, can you tell them all the things about the stuff?" You know, and so I found a way to kind of synthesize some of those bigger ideas into using video clips and things like that to teach them. And we just really had the idea, particularly Bob Hosack at Baker, that it would be really helpful to have a kind of synthesis of particularly the first three volumes of the series and for folks to read. And so that's where it came from. And then the co-author, is my friend Blair Bertrand, who's a Canadian guy, which you shouldn't hold against him for being Canadian. He's a good Canadian guy. And he's just a really good writer, and he's been a good friend for years. We were at Princeton Seminary together, and And we were, yeah, he knows these ideas really well, and then he knows how to communicate them. And I have the tendency to kind of follow rabbit trails and just start getting really into different philosophers and sociologists and things like that. And he's a little more disciplined and can say, let's just, you know, keep our feet on the ground here. So, yeah, so it having him kind of know the project inside and out, and then having him hold me accountable to writing it in a way that would connect with councils and lay people was really the objective behind it.
Well, the book definitely does that. I think it's really accessible. I think it's a great introduction. I hope if people read it, it'll make you want to dig deeper into your other work, because I think you can go about as deep as you want. One of the great things about your work too is it'll inspire you to read other things as well too, and really sort of begin this journey of trying to understand what the moment that we're in. That's really where this book opens, is trying to decide, is the church currently facing a moment of decline, or is this a moment of opportunity? I'm interested, as you're talking, you've been getting a lot of interest from people wanting you to come in and help explain this moment to them, explain what you've been writing about this moment. How do you understand the moment that the church is in, and what it is that we're looking at, we're facing right now?
Yeah, I think it would be completely illogical to say that we're not in a moment of crisis. You know, that I think everyone feels that this is that we're at, you know, crisis point, that the kind of gauge on the dashboard of the church is in the red, you know, that we feel that. The last thing we want to say is like, oh, don't worry, there's no crisis here. We think there is a crisis here, and that this cultural moment is one of crisis. But we think that inside of a crisis and the kind of fog of a crisis, it's very easy to misinterpret what the crisis is. And, we tend to interpret the crisis as that there's fewer of everything, you know, that there's mainly fewer people coming to church, and therefore there are fewer dollars, and therefore there are fewer resources overall. Therefore there are ultimately fewer churches and fewer congregations in our denomination, and maybe eventually here, fewer denominations. Like there feels like that's the crisis, that the crisis really is one of decline. And we think that there is a crisis, but that the crisis isn't of decline. I mean, that's real. We're not, you know, saying that you're miscounting or something like that. But we are saying that the real crisis that we face is the crisis of how we help people imagine a living God in the world, in that we do inherit a time where the idea that there's a living, speaking God who's moving in history, that there's a God who is God, and not just some kind of idea or kind of ethical precept or something like that, that becomes more and more unbelievable to people. So the real challenge of the congregation and the real necessity of the leaders within it is, how do we help people again encounter a living, speaking God, as opposed to thinking just how can we get more kind of resources, more money, more people, that we really think what will save the church, as has always saved the church, this is not a new idea, is that God will be responsible for the church, and God's action within the world will save the church, because the church is to serve the world by proclaiming that God is living and active and moving within the world.
This idea in the tagline of more money, programs, and innovation, it sort of makes me chuckle when I say it, because it's so much of what I learned ministry to be coming through Bible college, right? This was of the era of entrepreneurialism and thinking about church growth and programs, and everybody was creating mission statements and vision statements and core values, and reading leadership, you know, secular business books, and trying to apply those to the church. As you look back over the last few decades, how is it that business and that emphasis on business practices has been impacting the church, and where it sort of leaves us in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's had huge impact, and some of it's been good. I mean, I don't think we should undersell, or, you know, I'm not trying to just put us in some kind of enclave that doesn't want to learn from those realities or anything like that. But it has been really true that we've had this certain perspective, and maybe this is the best way to say that, where inside of that logic, we do think of the local congregation as a small business. And the first thing a small business has to figure out is, what is its story? Like, you know, why does it exist? What is its story it's going to tell the world, which will frame its marketing, which will kind of frame it, how it even views, like, what the market is it's trying to reach. So, you know, this is what we all were taught, like why we need a mission statement and things like that, because we need to figure out what our story is. And yet theologically, that's a problem because the church, I think, theologically doesn't have a story. It doesn't have its own story. The only story the church has is the very story of God that's bound in the very person of Jesus Christ. So the real story that the church has to give itself over to is not its own, like what it does, what difference it makes, but it has to give itself over to the very story of God's movement in the world, of God's action within the community that it finds itself. So the church never can be the star of its own story. And I think we often assume that we have to figure out how we can become the star of our own story. And the only way you win in this game is to find the kind of creative entrepreneurship that makes, you know, that makes you a star. And I think this is one of the big challenges in a kind of broader cultural vein, why kind of entrepreneurship and innovation is everywhere, is because it does become a kind of style that a self can take on to win, if you will, you know, to kind of win influence and win reach and win importance. And I think the church has felt like it's in deficit of all those things. So it's been very tempted to turn to those kind of realities to think about how it can renew itself. But any renewal movement throughout the history of the church has always been God's doing. And it often has come from the confession of the church or of the Christian that we don't have the power to save ourselves, that we don't have the power to solve these problems, that there's no creativity in us that can get us to where we need to be, but that we can surrender and make confessions and live in communities that are trying to be faithful to what God is doing. And I know that sounds really pietistic maybe, but we think that it is the only way to kind of find renewal in this moment, is to kind of double down on the faithfulness of God and God's responsibility for God's church, and for to have leaders really focus on the very practices of trying to discern how God is moving in the world. And, you know, very simple but very profound things like what it means to pray together and what it means to have a kind of shared story about how God has moved within this community, how to keep track of those stories, you know, that those stories they really are present. And it doesn't matter if your church has 10 people in it or 10,000 people. If you scratch the surface a little bit, people have all sorts of stories of moments of loss and brokenness where they felt the very ministering spirit of God come to them. And yet too often we don't have space or time or interest in those stories because we're thinking like, how can we get more people to come? Or why does that church across town have so many more people than we have? And there's something tragic lost in that. That is, I think, really at the heart of what it means to confess Jesus Christ.
It is interesting to think about the kind of archetypal hero or leader of our day is probably one of innovation. It's like the Steve Jobs figure versus maybe an archetypal leader who would have been, you know, based on character or some sort of heroic sacrifice, or perhaps a philosopher of the past or orator maybe in time past. That today's, it really is this idea of innovation and a kind of a pragmatism that's able to create new things. That seems to be what we're looking for, drawn to, aspire to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And yet we're also at a moment where we're finding out, if we're willing to really look closely enough, we're finding that has really boomeranged on us and has become incredibly toxic. You know, like you just think of all the stories of all these really winners, we can throw that in, you know, kind of scare quotes, the winners of the decline game, you know, these churches and even movements of folks who found a way to build huge churches. You know, my wife Car and I just got done watching the Hillsong, you know, 4-part documentary on Hulu. And you do realize that a huge piece of this is that once you get on this growth engine, I mean, once you keep kind of accelerating towards that, once you kind of, find the innovative secret sauce, you can never stop it. And this is the kind of diabolical, we could even kind of say demonic part of this, is once you get on the accelerating growth engine, well, there's no getting off of it. I mean, if you grow at 20% this year, to be successful next year, you need to grow at another 20%. I mean, if you just, the kind of logic doesn't exist within us that says, oh, well, we grew 15% last year, so this year we don't really need to grow at all. As a matter of fact, we could lose 5% of people and or 5% of our resources or 5% of our reach, and we'd still be ahead 10% from 2 years ago. It's not how it works. You know, this is just not how it works inside of the kind of systems that we exist in. That if you grow 15 or 20%, that doesn't give you latitude to kind of take your foot off the accelerator and to relax and to live in the moment and to remember you're alive. No, you have to now grow more. So you can see that in some ways, like, growth becomes a quite dangerous thing. It can become diabolically dangerous to your soul. And we're kind of seeing a reckoning in that. And that's not to say that all big churches equal, you know, these terrible pastoral moments. But it is interesting that when we do audits on those, it had a lot to do with the fact that people felt utter anxiety and fright of not keeping the growing going. And other folks who felt uneasy with it kind of justified it by saying, well, you know, I don't know, I don't like Pastor so-and-so's behavior, or they are intimidating people. But they did take this church from 8 people in a living room to 8,000 people, you know. So, you know, I guess you know, you have to take a little bit, you have to take a little bit of the downside with the upside. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that is a real concern we have to watch out for, you know, that, once you get on this rocket of acceleration, you can never stop it. And, that becomes a problem.
One of the other patterns you unpack in the book is how this idea of more can lead churches, can lead pastors to begin to use people. I often think of it as sort of the volunteer mentality, that as soon as you're here, you get a t-shirt and now you become part of the fuel that keeps the machine running. And the number of people who can get really burnt out and hurt in a religious setting, a church setting, where really they've just become a volunteer or a tool within the church's tool belt to continue that growth.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. This is not a podcast about the Hillsong documentary, but you saw that, you know, like the people who were volunteers and it needed volunteers to continue, all of a sudden started to feel like that they were just objects. And this is the problem with the continued acceleration that has been kind of part of my work for, you know, quite a while now, is that the real temptation is it turns all the relationships we have into instruments. It instrumentalizes all relationships. And so you just start to even see, like, okay, this person here that's before me, how do I parlay this relationship into more, you know, whether that's more money, more giving, or whether it's more people coming because they influence others to come. Like, everything becomes instrumentalized in that way. And we lose something that's just utterly central about the gospel story and really the whole breadth of the kind of Judeo-Christian reality, which is this sense that this God is not a fertility God. You know, like, one of the big moves in the Old Testament is that Israel comes to realize that this God, that Yahweh, is not a fertility God like the Canaanite gods. This God is not bound in growth, that this God is actually much more like a mother to a child, like a father to a child. And, you know, it doesn't take much of walking around the symbolism and the icons of the Eastern and the Western church when you get back into the medieval period or whatever, and you visit Rome or you visit, you know, Istanbul today, old Constantinople, to see how much imagery there is of the Madonna and the child, which is very much a contrasting narrative to the fertility God. I am concerned that kind of American Protestantism really is looking for a fertility God and not the God who comes in Jesus Christ and sits in the lap of his mother, you know, not the God who's made known in this deep Trinitarian language of father and son, and what it means to share in each other's lives, not instrumentally, but to participate in each other's being so deeply. And I think that's something we do have to reckon with. And I think we hope that this book kind of frees us from worshiping the Baals. I know that sounds really dramatic in some ways, but that is, you know, that's what Israel is called from. I mean, it's an agricultural society, and the Baals are fertility gods. And Israel always goes back to the fertility gods because they think what we think right now, which is, you know, maybe it would be good to Yahweh's good, but maybe it'd be also good to, you know, like, hedge our bets and put a little money on the fertility gods so that we can have a good harvest, so we can have more resources, so we don't feel the crunch of decline. And I think, of course, Israel's always called back to stay inside this dynamic relationship of children to a parent, as opposed to those who are kind of instrumentally serving a
a fertility god.
I think that's a really, really helpful image for framing it. When I first read When Church Stops Working, I was tracking with you, as I've sort of alluded to, so much of this is my own experience in ministry and how I was trained in ministry. And then when I got to what really is, I think, your kind of call of the book, which is the idea, the importance of waiting, it really kind of caught me a little bit off guard. I mean, you would imagine, you know, maybe you call the church to some sort of monastic way of living or some way of simplification or some intentional small group ministry, but you really don't propose a solution along those lines. Instead, the book tries to raise the level of importance of being and waiting within the life of the church, the life of an individual believer. Maybe you could talk a little bit about why waiting is important and how you came to recognize that.
Yeah, I mean, even talking about it with you, I feel deeply insecure about it, because I think one of the things, especially as kind of middle class Americans, we're taught is that waiting is bad, you know, especially if you're, you know, I don't know how old you are, but, you know, I'm in my, I'll just stick with my mid 40s, even though that's not quite as true anymore. But, you know, like the whole point is like waiting is terrible. Like, you know, all of our technological innovations was to kind of take the wanting out of waiting. And, you know, now, you know, like my kids have no idea what it even really means to like wait for a show to arrive. I guess some streaming services now like release them on the week, but you know, like the Netflix model where you get every episode the minute it drops, like there's just waiting has been kind of the enemy, I think, of late modernity.
Yeah. There's certainly more binging than waiting. I definitely think that's true.
That is true, that we've been more into binging, which, you know, again, these are very interesting kind of, using the kind of fertility images again and the kind of agricultural images of that, that, you know, binging, a spirituality of binging versus spirituality of waiting. But I guess our big point here is that, if the crisis that we have to confront is not a crisis of decline, but the crisis of how we imagine again that there's a living God speaking and moving in the world, then the first step to that will be to stop and to wait and to remember that God is God and we are not. And, you know, this God of Israel is a God who moves, but this God moves on God's own timing. You know, this is a God who calls God's people into waiting all the time. And it isn't a kind of waiting, I don't think, that is a waiting like waiting for your delayed flight in the airport, where you just feel absolutely stuck, you know, like you feel caught. It's a kind of waiting that is waiting for something to occur, that's waiting for an advent, that's waiting for an event of arrival, but it's a waiting nevertheless. And I think this is really important for us to take our first step into reimagining that this God acts and moves, is to, instead of frantically thinking of what do we have to do to save ourselves, I think the first move of the old Christian tradition is to stop and wait for God's gift that comes in anticipation. You know, like we get a deep sense of waiting in Luke's narrative of Jesus' birth, you know, that John the Baptist comes after years of waiting, that of course Abraham and Sarah, it is waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting until things seem utterly impossible that God moves, that it doesn't take much to see how much waiting is an essential piece of the biblical text. And we do think, I mean, we often, you know, we're often told that the church has its birth in Acts 2, where Pentecost happens, which of course is true in many ways. But the first command that the church gets that we try to raise is not in Acts 2, but in Acts 1, where after the experience, the epiphany of the resurrected Christ on the road to Emmaus, Jesus calls the disciples to go to Jerusalem and to wait. That the church really starts in waiting, in being in a stance of waiting to receive the very gift of God, the very presence of God. And yet even saying that as a kind of middle-class, middle-aged American, you just feel like, no. If things aren't good, you just do more. You know, like if you don't feel good, figure something out. Do more. And the only way we're going to be okay is finding a way to do more. Yet I just don't think that that's the spirituality that promises,
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, that promises a little bit of this monastic encounter with the living God. You know, I think in many ways, the monastic life is a life of waiting, of waiting in prayer, of waiting with a story that you hold. So it feels very counterintuitive, I think, to a lot of us. But it is definitely not counter to the kind of unfoldings of the Christian tradition and the biblical text itself.
I grew up in a charismatic Pentecostal tradition where the idea of tarrying, which was the idea of waiting, was really a part of the way you practice prayer, you practice faith. And it's, as I was reading, I kept thinking, boy, you just, even in my own tradition, you hear about that word or that language less, where it used to be so central. Certainly something about our world today is just sped up. I mean, technology has certainly done that. But is there something more in the secular mindset, the secular framework that it's making it so difficult to wait?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that this is really true. And, you know, one of the thinkers that's under the surface of this book, which, you know, you kindly said that, you know, in the other books, there's a lot of footnotes of other things to read and other dialogues happening. I was told in this book there could be no footnotes. So, you know, those
less Charles Taylor mentioned. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So those readers who I have been known to be a footnoteaholic. So, this was my, like, you know, jump off the wagon, or onto the wagon. I don't know whatever the analogy is. So there is no footnotes here, but, you know, in the subtext here, or one of the thinkers that you can find a lot of footnotes in the other books is Hartmut Rosa, the German social theorist, who really thinks what it means to be a modern person is to find every part of our lives always speeding up. Our experience of technology, like you referenced, but also just social change, you know, like you just have to watch a few episodes from The Office in season 3 or 4, even, you know, let alone even the last season, you start to realize that the jokes they said then you can't say now. Like, just the change socially has been incredibly fast. And then just the pace of our lives, it just feels like things continue to speed up. But underneath all that, what Rosa thinks has occurred, which we're really playing with in this book, is that the way you stabilize any institution, and in many ways, the way you stabilize your own life, is what he calls dynamic stabilization. And what he means is growth. Like, the way a company stabilizes itself and will be around is it just has to continue to grow. And once it doesn't grow, it no longer has value. And this becomes a crazy thing, you know. So if your company grows by 15%, the next year you need to grow more, another 15%. But if your growth falls below 5%, then, well, it's not investable anymore, and you should just, you know, sell it for parts. And so this is the kind of the reality that just continues to speed up our lives, is that we just feel like, personally and even subjectively, let alone institutionally, that things just need to continue to grow, and we need to continue to push for growth. And I think one of the diabolical elements of this that becomes a real spiritual crisis is it's not even a sense of growing to have more. It's growing just to not be left behind. You know, like, if we feel that with our own children, like if we don't get them involved in all these things, it's not even delusions of them being first round draft picks. It's just the fact that they're not going to be able to play on the U11 team because they didn't go to 8 camps and be involved in all this stuff. You know, so we feel like we have to do more and more just to stay in the same place. And I think we feel that ecclesially too. I think we feel that as the church, like we just have to keep doing more and more and more to stay in place, or the church will die. And I think that does distract us from the deeper realities, which is, what does it mean? What does it mean pastorally? What does it mean as lay people in leadership to just walk with people in life and death? Well, that becomes far less important than just trying to keep ourselves stabilized by growing more and more and more. And so there's a lot going on there. And that ultimately leads to huge levels of burnout, and just the level of stress we have to bear because we just continue to put more energy into more actions. You know, that just becomes a huge burden we bear.
I was thinking, as you were talking, about a scene from Eugene Peterson's memoir where he talks about their church getting started and gathering people and building a church and designing it and the construction process. And the church was growing. And he said, you know, for the first 2 or 3 weeks after they were in the new building, it was their biggest attendance. And then slowly attendance started to decline and people were sort of drifting. He felt the community sort of falling apart. And he went to his overseer denominationally. And the advice he was given was, you need to start a new building program. And he said, well, we've got plenty of room. We just finished. And his overseer said, all people understand is the next project. So you've got to give them the next project. I think that's exactly what you're describing, right? Yep. People only belong if there's something new coming, the sort of FOMO driving us, always bigger, always better. That really, that's how so many of us have learned to belong or engage in Christian community.
Yeah. And that's the only thing that stabilizes you, you know, like it just, there's no stabilization. There's no investment, without it. But yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, what we're trying to do here and a lot of the project that this all builds on is really trying to raise and put in deeper conversation a lot of the points that Peterson made years ago, you know, about what it really means to think about being a pastor and being a church and the faithfulness to a living God in the midst of it.
You write in the book that churches should seek to have a watchword, not just a mission statement. There's lots and lots of advice and lots of definitions and tools and books for pastors wanting to develop a mission statement. What does it mean for a church, a pastor, to develop a watchword?
Yeah, I mean, I think a watchword is something that it makes more sense. I just got back from Europe, and you'll sometimes hear this like pop up even in stories on the continent or in the UK or whatever, where people just know the kind of concept of a watchword more than Americans. It's really not in our imagination, but the idea of it simply is like, what is the shorthand of a larger story that's framing your imagination? And you know, like we try to contrast a mission statement with a watchword because we think a mission statement really is about the church being the star of its own story. What's the church's story? But a watchword is really a shorthand story of how God has moved in this community. And it's really a lens, if you will, to hold before the congregation of how God has moved within the midst of this, how God has acted, for us. And we do think the kind of waiting we're calling for is not, again, the kind of waiting at the doctor's office or a waiting at the airport with a delayed flight where you're just kind of like, just feel stuck. It's a kind of waiting with a story. It's waiting on watch, watching for, looking at the world through, if you will, this shorthand of the story. So we end the book by giving some examples of that, of these watchwords of congregations that maybe wouldn't even have called it a watchword, but essentially had a shorthand of a story that framed them. And, you know, the one that comes to mind from the end of the story is this couple who, were Sunday school teachers, said that they were teaching a seventh grade Sunday school class. And the pastor I reference is this incredible pastor who's just retired named Mike Wood. And Mike is just an incredibly talented pastor. And he started at this church. This is, you know, now 30 years ago or something like that, 30, 40 years ago. And he noticed that the seventh grade Sunday school teachers were doing very weird things and not following any of his lesson plans. And he'd find the class in the weird places, like the boiler room of the church. And always they were under the table, and he felt a little annoyed that they just weren't following his expertise on how to do this. And yet he started to discover that these seventh graders were incredibly moved by the class. And then people started telling him stories about how they'd been out of, you know, they'd been out of seventh grade for 7-8 years, and they were still getting phone calls on their birthday. And the Jurgensons, these Sunday school teachers, were singing, and they would sing to these kids their happy birthday on the phone every year. And Mike started to realize there was something going on here. So he went to them curiously and was like, what are you doing? And, you know, and, you know, it seems like you're great Sunday school teachers, but tell me how is this happening? And they actually were very deferential and were like, oh, we're so sorry. And we're actually terrible Sunday school teachers because we really only have one lesson. And the one lesson we teach kids is that nothing can separate them from God. That nothing can separate them. That's all we ever teach them, is that nothing can separate them. And then they ended up telling this incredible story about their own son, who was hearing impaired, who they loved and felt a lot of kind of in the 70s, felt a lot of kind of cultural estrangement and things like that. And they used to keep telling their son over and over again, nothing can separate you from the love of God. And then their son came of age and was married and ended up dying of a disease. And then the Jurgensons themselves only got through this deep suffering because they remembered that nothing, even this incredible loss, could not separate them from the love of God. So now all they did with every Sunday school class was teach them that nothing could separate you from the love of God. And Mike heard that. And it's like, that's amazing. And they started preaching sermons on it. And they started referencing it in the congregation that nothing can separate you from the love of God. And that became their watchword. They went out into the world. They looked at each other's stories of their lives and always remembered that there's nothing that could separate you from the love of God. And Mike says, you'll find a watchword when people start talking in your church and it starts sounding like scripture. Pay attention, because that may be your watchword. Well, it became so important that a few years into them kind of having this as their watchword and continuing to talk about it, they had a mother in their congregation who got, they don't know what was wrong. She was going through a crisis and they think maybe she had Lyme disease. She just, something wasn't right. And in the midst of that, she ended up committing suicide. And this watchword, nothing can separate you from the love of God, became so profound to the church. And it shaped them for a decade. And then Mike's point is you have to renew your watchword once in a while. New stories start to form. But it's the idea that God is moving within the congregation and that people will just come to describe it. And the leader's job is to raise these little stories and call the whole congregation to see their lives and to see the congregation itself through this watchword. So we think a mission statement's important, you know, why the church itself exists, but not more important than a watchword. A watchword is the kind of testifying to what God is doing. It's the taking people into having a shared story of the way God acts and moves within the midst of their community.
I do want to ask a couple of questions as a way of wrapping up. I want to get to specifically what pastors can do with this, but maybe before then, for the average believer Christian who finds themselves burnt out, tired, feeling their world constantly speeding up and seeing the ways that that's impacting the way that they participate in worship and faith. I think most of us as pastors are seeing people's attendance habits change. People are, the way I joke about it is used to people would say, hey, sorry, I missed Sunday. We were at the lake. And now it's, hey, sorry, I missed. We were at the lake Saturday. You know, and if I have anything else going on around Sunday, believers are feeling that. They are feeling the kind of tired anxiety that you're describing. What is the way to begin doing this? What is your way into this kind of waiting when it feels so counterintuitive, when it actually feels in a way risky in the world that we live in right now for an average believer?
Yeah, I mean, part of the whole challenge of this, and you know, I think some people who read our stuff will have a kind of visceral reaction against it, is because a huge piece of it is that it's uncontrollable. You know, that there's a certain level of uncontrollability, and this is what we want you to wait for. I mean, it has to be waiting because God is God, and you can't control God. You know, like if we could tell you, you say these words, and then God shows up, or you do, you know, you stand on your right leg and put your left hand on your nose, and then God will do stuff. Then we wouldn't be talking about God. We'd be talking about some magical incantation, some, you know, some spirit we control, or some technology that we can operate, or something like that. But we're talking about the very God who is God, and this God will move how God wants to move, and this God will be present as God wants to be present. And we have to be reminded that God is God and we are not, and all we can do is continue to wait for this God. And so there is a sense where we have to learn, and this is a huge task of leadership, to embrace the uncontrollability, and that actually the most profound realities in our lives are always uncontrollable. I mean, the love we have with our spouse or even our children, a huge piece of that is uncontrollable. You know, the once you try to control it, this is back to the kind of instrumentalization. Once you try to control every relationship you have to turn it into an instrument. You have to turn it into an object. It no longer becomes a deep event of encounter. So I think the first thing we can do is stop and to wait, and to trust that God is faithful in the uncontrollability. But I think that is about reminding people that the greatest gift the church can give you, especially kind of worship on Sundays, is just to be these people in this place. And that really is a ripoff from Aziz Ansari's comedy show, which we reference in the book, where he has this moment of taking the group into just being these people in this moment. And there's something profound about it. But we also try to remind people, and I guess these are the other practicalities, is that that starts by making a confession and living in gratitude. You know, that he starts by saying, you know, I used to say thank you very much when I ended the show, but I didn't mean it. I never really meant it. I was just on to the next thing. But now, because of this suffering he's gone through, because of a loss that he's experienced, he's much more cognizant of being in this moment, of not moving on to the next thing, but being present here. And that causes him to have to see the humanity of others and to be actually very grateful that they're there. In the Christian life, especially in its Protestant form, the real call of human action is to live in gratitude, gratitude to God, gratitude to one another, that we've had a God who's acted for us and saved us in the working of the cross and the resurrection. And so I think that there does start with this ability to kind of make confessions of these places in our lives that do feel overwhelmed and where we do feel lost, and then to say thank you for those who hear these stories. And I know that still is a huge challenge, which you raise, you know, really quite profoundly, which is that we still have to gather people. And that becomes harder and harder in this moment. How do we gather people? But my sense is that gathering people and the necessity of gathering bodies together, we're not going to solve that problem by just saying that we're going to become these great entrepreneurs. That feels exciting at the front end, but it ends up ultimately meaning that people have to do more and more with less. And I think one of our first steps is to stop again, to teach people to pray, to teach people to tell their stories to one another, and then to have a whole spirit within the congregation that can say thank you to each other. I think that becomes a huge piece. It still feels quite nebulous in some ways because it is uncontrollable, but it really ultimately becomes about how do we have these experiences of each other's humanity as we yearn for the presence of God.
I often will say to my congregation that one of the most important spiritual disciplines I know is just showing up. And I don't mean it as be good about attendance. I mean it as more than that, of just being present, of waiting, of not coming with an agenda, but just being amongst God's people and seeing what God is doing. Your advice for pastors, again, I mean, pick up a copy of When Church Stops Working. I think this conversation is reflective of the kinds of conversations we as pastors certainly need right now to help our imagination be able to perceive another way. But for a pastor who is feeling sort of overwhelmed and anxious and that constant pressure for more and bigger, how do you go about beginning to untangle that, to practice a kind of waiting, and even larger for a pastor to lead a congregation into it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first step is for us to realize, to not kind of be prisoners of the moment, and to realize that these are not great times for the church. You know, no one will look back on the first three decades of the 21st century and say, well, this was the golden age of Protestantism, or this was a real important, you know, important time of institutional growth and things like that. We are in a rough spot. And we can feel really guilty about that. I mean, I think that this is the kind of diabolical piece of the kind of innovative acceleration narrative of decline, is that you can do more and you can stop this. And if it does go bad, and if your church has to close, or you just never see more than 4 or 5% growth, well, it's your fault. You weren't creative enough. You didn't have enough energy. You lost. You were a loser. And I think we have to release ourselves from that. Well, these are not the golden era, but we also have to remind ourselves that there have been worse times, that the church has experienced far worse times, that, you know, like if you were part of the church in the 10th, 11th century in England or Scotland, you had Viking raiders coming to your shores, you know, like stealing your chalice to the Eucharist and, you know, sticking a sword in a Sunday school teacher. Like those were pretty tough times. And so the church has had more difficult periods than this, and God has seen it through, and God will see it through again. And what you're called to is not to save the church. All the saving is God's work. You're called to just faithfully, to kind of quote Peterson again, walk the long, slow walk in the same direction with these people. And what that really means is the joy and the burden of living with these people, of helping them live and die, helping them find meaning in the midst of their living and dying, that it is an incredible privilege. There's nothing else like it in our cultural reality, where there's a community of people, where there is a person called a pastor who leads that community of people into life and death, and into making meaning in the midst of it. I think that's quite a beautiful thing. And we can lose all of that because we think, oh my gosh, I'll feel incredibly guilty if we lose our church, or if how can I look myself in the mirror if I am not the star in my denomination? And that will end up making something other than the faithfulness of living with these people, being with these people in this moment. It'll make something else more important than that.
Yeah, I think that's a great word, a great final image, and one of hope, one of gratitude. I believe in being a pastor. I know you believe in the calling as well, too. And I hope those listening find themselves encouraged by it as well, too. Difficult times, but I think as you put it so well, too, God walks with us in these times, and there's good work ahead for all of us. The book, When Church Stops Working, A Future for Your Congregation Beyond More Money, Programs, and Innovation. Andy, it's just a great book. I highly, highly recommend it. And your work has always been meaningful and helpful to me. So I've got it all, and I'll be buying the next one when it comes out as well, too. And so I just want to say thanks for the work you've been putting in over these years, helping guide us, and excited for more things to come for you as well.
Well, I'm honored, and thanks for another great conversation.
As always, you can find show notes for today's episode by going to pastorwriter.com. There'll be a link to Andrew's book that we discussed in today's podcast. And I also just wanted to remind you that in addition to the Five Masculine Instincts being available, there's a new print study guide. Maybe you've downloaded the PDF version online to use with your men's small group, but you can now get it in a print format. It includes personal reflection questions, group discussion questions, access to the assessment that you can take online, as well as some new content. It has article introductions for each of the chapters, as well as an overall introduction. So you can get that study guide in print at Amazon.com. You can find links on the Pastor Writer website for that as well. As always, thanks for listening. Until next time.